Fatherless Fanny by Anonymous. Chapter 21. The Concert. The two ladies who accompanied the Marchioness of Petersfield's family party to the opera had a box adjoining her ladyship's, and as that could boast a better view of the stage, Miss Stanhope accepted their offer of sitting there in preference to the Marchioness's. And as she was known to be inseparable from Fanny, a seat was also offered to her. The first act was nearly over when they entered the house, and the first object that struck Fanny on her entrance was Mr. Hamilton sitting in the pit with his arms folded across his breast and his eyes pensively fixed upon the part of the house where their box was situated. He instantly recognized Fanny, and rising from his seat, made her a low bow. Confused beyond measure at this public salute, the deepest crimson covered her cheeks. But she, nevertheless, returned the compliment by a slight inclination of the head. This did not pass unobserved by Colonel Ross, who was in the back part of the box talking to Lord Cheviotdale, and exclaimed in the first ebullition of fury, "Curse the fellow!" Colonel Ross was unconscious that he had spoken aloud, until Lord Cheviotdale, whose eyes had followed the Colonel's, as it glanced at the object of his anger, asked him with surprise if he meant Mr. Hamilton. "But," added his lordship, recollecting himself, "that is impossible, for everybody that knows Mr. Hamilton likes him." "I know very little of that gentleman," said the Colonel, "nor do I wish to increase the acquaintance, for he resembles a person I detest." And it was that likeness which forced from my lips the apostrophe that surprised you. "By heaven," rejoined Lord Cheviotdale, "if Hamilton be like anybody who is unamiable, it can be only an exterior resemblance. Therefore, to do away with such unjust prejudices, I shall immediately fetch him hither, and I will bet £10,000 you recant your unfavorable opinion in half an hour afterwards." The Marquis did not wait for Colonel Ross to answer, but, quitting the box, made his way into the pit, and returned in a very few minutes, accompanied by Mr. Hamilton. "I have fulfilled my promise," said his lordship, addressing the Marchioness of Petersfield. "Here is Mr. Hamilton, drawn hither by the ardent desire he feels to be introduced to your ladyship." The Marchioness put on one of her most gracious looks, and replied, "That she should esteem herself happy in the honour of Mr. Hamilton's acquaintance." Colonel Ross bit his lip, and received his share of the introductory ceremony with stiff politeness. Miss Stanhope looked at Lord Cheviotdale with an air of reproach, who instantly understood the hint, and whispering to Mr. Hamilton, led him into the adjoining box, where he renewed the ceremony of introduction both to Miss Stanhope and her friend. The ladies who were in the same box were acquainted with Mr. Hamilton, and gave him so cordial a reception that he accepted their invitation to take a seat in their box. And placing himself behind Fanny, he addressed the chief part of his conversation to her and Miss Stanhope, whose lively sallies seemed to please him much, and often awakened a sweet smile upon his pensive countenance. There was solid sense in everything Mr. Hamilton said, and he expressed himself in such elegant language that Fanny listened to him with delight, whilst her soft eyes beamed upon him a look of the sweetest complacency. The Duke of Albemarle, who was in the box adjoining, had watched Fanny with all the tortures of jealousy from the first moment of Mr. Hamilton's introduction. And when he read upon her intelligent countenance such unequivocal proofs of her admiration of the man he deemed his rival, he could scarce rein in his rage and indignation. Alarmed lest his emotions should betray him, he left the box, and endeavored to recover his self-command by a walk in the adjoining corridor. Sir Everard Mornington was at the opera that evening, and as soon as he espied Miss Stanhope, he hastened to join her party. Sir Everard was one of those lively people who who are at home everywhere and acquainted with everybody. He entered the box, therefore, without ceremony, and after a slight nod and "How do?" to Amelia, he began a long story to one of the old ladies about a narrow escape he had experienced in the morning, having been thrown out of the dog-cart tandem which he was driving, to the imminent risk of his own neck, and the total demolition of the poor woman's wheelbarrow that had caused the accident by crossing the street just at the moment young Jehu was driving down Bond Street in the true style of prime and bang up. "Good heavens," said Miss Stanhope, "you talk so shockingly that positively I shall be nervous whenever I see anybody driving tandem or four in hand again."
"Don't alarm yourself," replied her lover. "There is nothing so delightful to a man of spirit as a hair's breadth escape now and then. It gives them éclat. Now, this accident will be in all the papers, and I shall be the topic of conversation for these 3 days. I wish I had broken my collarbone, or dislocated my arm, or some snug little accident. That would have been prime, for there must have been a bulletin, and all my friends, or at least my soi-disant friends, must have been very sorry, whether they would or not."
Miss Stanhope laughed.
"You are the first person," said she, "I ever heard wish to break his bones or dislocate his joints for the sake of notoriety. And I think, as you are so ambitious of fame, you had better join the army in Portugal, and there you may stand a fair chance of having your head taken off in a celebrated manner by a cannonball, or of losing some of your limbs at least."
"Losing a limb or so might be very well if it happened in England, but as to the head," replied Sir Everard, "the loss of that would spoil all, for there would be no occasion for a bulletin. And as service abroad are equally preclusive of that delightful oblation to vanity, I will serve my country at home by encouraging its breed of horses, employing its mechanics in building carriages, and gratifying the most beautiful part of its population by sporting my elegant figure in all the paraphernalia of a modern son of the whip. When encouraged by their approving glances, I become invincible to the dangers of my elevated station, and squaring my elbows, I handle the ribbons and tip my tits in their traces such a dasher that we are prime and bang up beyond all competition."
Miss Stanhope was not deficient in sense, and yet she was charmed with a jargon that had not a particle of that quality to boast of. There is no accounting for partialities between the sexes, as it may be very frequently observed that persons of the most opposite tastes and propensities will select each other, and consider it indispensable to their mutual happiness to be united. The brilliant alliance which fortune seemed to offer her in her union with the Duke had no attraction in her eyes, nor could his Grace's elegant person, his fine understanding, nor the fascination of his manners, tempt her for a moment to forego her choice. Sir Everard Mornington was a fine, healthy-looking young man, and might perhaps have displayed something like a mind, had studying been the fashion instead of driving. But the company he had been obliged to keep in order to attain any degree of perfection in the science he was ambitious to shine in had as completely vulgarized his ideas as the quaint dress of the natty coachman had disfigured his naturally fine person. Yet still, in Miss Stanhope's eyes, he was all perfection, and as she was no less agreeable to him, there had been an explanation between them that had developed their views to each other. A clandestine marriage had been decided on, and the giddy couple anticipated with delight the noise their elopement would make in the great world. Sir Everard was rich, and therefore Miss Stanhope's fortune was not his object in addressing her. And when she explained to him the clause in her father's will, which made her fortune the penalty of her refusing to marry the Duke of Albemarle, he laughed, and told her
He thought it would be prime to tip the knowing ones the go-by, and show them they had more spirit than to mind what musty old parchments said, that helped do the mischief the old quizzes that made them could not live to finish.
But to return to the opera house. Mr. Hamilton, in the course of the conversation, learned that Fanny was going out of town, and when Miss Stanhope named Lady Ellencourt's seat in Yorkshire, he clapped his hand to his forehead and exclaimed, "Heavens, what a circumstance!"
"Do you know that part of the world?"
said Miss Stanhope, whose curiosity had been raised by the exclamation.
"Know it?" rejoined Mr. Hamilton. "Oh, would to God I had never known it!"
Miss Stanhope was alarmed, for she thought Mr. Hamilton was insane, as his eyes rolled for several minutes with a wildness truly terrific.
"I thought," said she, endeavoring to turn the conversation, "that you were a stranger in this country, sir, and had been in England only a few months."
"Most true," replied Mr. Hamilton, seeming to recover himself a little. "I am a stranger in this country. I have no existence here."
"But I am trespassing on your attention, ladies," continued he, turning to Miss Stanhope and Fanny, "whilst more pleasing objects demand it. The name of the estate that formerly belonged to my deceased friend awakened ideas most painful to recall. But it is over, and I entreat your pardon."
It was in vain that Mr. Hamilton recommended to Miss Stanhope and Fanny to give their attention to the opera. He had fixed it for the night, and they could neither of them hear or see any other person. As to Fanny, she was affected beyond measure by the anguish expressed on the countenance of her new friend, and she found it difficult to restrain the tears that were ready to drop from her eyes. Mr. Hamilton perceived her emotion, and fearful lest it should attract the notice of the ladies around her, he rose from his seat and quitted the box. The Duke of Albemarle entered as he did so, and placing himself behind Fanny, he remained stationary until the party quitted the theater. It was in vain, however, that he addressed his conversation to Fanny, or indeed to Miss Stanhope. So lost were they in conjectures as to the possible cause of Mr. Hamilton's sorrow, that a monosyllable was the utmost the Duke could obtain in answer to anything that he said. Inflamed with jealousy and exasperated beyond the bounds of prudence, he seized Fanny's arm as she was entering the coffee-room, and darting at her a look of anger, he said, in a tone of voice that spoke his inward emotion,
"Inexorable girl! Forbear to trifle thus with my happiness. Remember, my life is in your hands. Never will I marry any other woman." "Then you will die single," said a harsh voice behind him,
and at the same moment he felt a hand grasp his arm with violence. He turned round and beheld Lord Summertown, who immediately obliged him to quit Fanny and go with him.
"I came hither," said his lordship, "in search of my nephew, little imagining what a fool I was looking for."
Ashamed and confused beyond expression, the Duke suffered himself to be led away by Lord Summertown, who had taken hold of his arm, to his carriage, without proffering a single word. His uncle was silent also for some time after they were seated in the chariot. At length, however, he spoke.
"I had formed a better opinion of your understanding," said his lordship. "A man may trifle with as many women as he pleases, but when he so far forgets himself as to talk of marriage, he deserves to be posted for a blockhead. An intrigue with the companion of your intended wife is most ridiculously indiscreet, and particularly so before you are secure of her. It is not morality I am preaching to you, for you already know my opinion on that subject, and all I wish to inculcate is a prudent regard to my wishes and your own interest. I have set my mind upon this union, and if it fails through your delinquency, woe unto the frail cause of it. You know me, Henry. Take care, then, how you offend me. If you value the painted puppet you were pretending to worship in that fulsome strain of idolatry, beware of drawing down my displeasure upon her. If I thought she stood in the way of your marriage with Miss Stanhope, by heavens, I would annihilate her! She should vanish from your fascinated eyes, nor leave a trace of her insignificant existence behind her.
The Duke shuddered as he listened to Lord Summertown's threatening language, for well did he know that if the power were lent him, he did not want the will to execute the direst vengeance on those he deemed his enemies. The bare idea of exposing the lovely Fanny to his uncle's fury was dreadful to him, and he resolved to dissemble his real sentiments under a show of obedience.
"I am concerned," said he, hesitating from the consciousness of a duplicity to which his soul was a stranger. "I am concerned that your lordship should mistake a little unmeaning gallantry shown to a young beautiful woman for a serious attachment. I have told your lordship that it was my wish to marry Miss Stanhope, and I now assure you that I still admire the same lady that then occupied my heart, in preference to all others. And if I don't marry Amelia Stanhope, the impediment to our union will not originate in me."
"Bravo!" exclaimed Lord Summertown. "If you are sincere, it is well. But think not that I am to be deceived by a stripling like you. That girl is an artful creature who has her views and her pretended coyness. But I repeat, beware how you let me suspect anything serious in that quarter. Remember, it will be at the peril of your minion."
The Duke again affirmed that he was ready to fulfill the contract with Miss Stanhope, and Lord Summertown was, or at least appeared to be, satisfied. When, however, he retired to his apartment, the agitation of the Duke's mind was intolerable. He had pledged his word to his uncle to marry Miss Stanhope, provided she was willing to accept him as a husband, and although the promise was extorted by his fears for Fanny's safety, he could not for an instant conceive the possibility of forfeiting his word, should she, contrary to her solemn assurances, place no barrier in the way of their nuptials.
"Good heavens," said he, "what would become of me should I find myself entangled in a net of my own weaving? Amelia has promised to render our marriage impossible. Is she then betrothed to another? And does she mean to evade her union with me by running away with her favored lover? Alas, her schemes may be rendered abortive by the vigilance of her guardians, and between threats and persuasions she may be brought to consent to the annihilation of my happiness. Well, should that be the case, I must console myself by reflecting that my fears for the adored object of my affection led me to the fatal sacrifice. Had I appeared irresolute or hesitated in answering my uncle, his vengeance would have fallen on the defenseless Fanny, and then the agony of my soul would have been too much for me to support. No, I have acted in the only way that was left me to ensure her safety, and if that were purchased with my life, it were cheaply bought. But I will cherish better hopes. Amelia Stanhope is generous. She will be faithful, and I shall yet possess the power of addressing the only woman I can ever love." With these reflections, fluctuating between hope and fear, the Duke passed a sleepless night, and awoke the next morning dispirited and pale from the anxiety that still preyed upon his spirits. In the meantime, Fanny had not been much more calm, but her agitation had not originated in the same cause, for love had nothing to do with the emotions that harassed her mind. An interest that she could not define
was excited in her heart for Mr. Hamilton, and it was with a mixture of terror and joy that she received the following note from him, as he was assisting her to get into the Marchioness of Petersfield's carriage. She counted the minutes till she was alone and free to peruse it, for she would not trust even Miss Stanhope with the knowledge of her having received it. The instant her lively friend had bid her good night, she tore open the seal with a trembling hand and read the following mysterious words: "You are going to Pemberton Abbey. So am I, and I trust we shall there find an opportunity of meeting without spies or intruders. I want to tell you the history of my eventful life. Something whispers me that you are interested in it beyond what you at present suspect. Oh, should it prove so, what bliss for both of us! I dare not trust the thought. Farewell until we meet again." End of chapter 21.